The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Fun fact, if you cut off your left arm, your right arm would be left.
Welcome everyone. It is Wednesday, October 1st, 2025. I'm Bob Ment, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right wing, it's just right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Cutting off your left arm is not the only way to turn something right into something that's left. Just attach the word wing to the right, and once again, the right has been left out. And if that sounds a bit screwy to you, just wait till you hear how many intelligent and relatively informed people painfully struggle to deal with the simple polarized political binary of left and right. The confusing spectrum of their interpretations is nevertheless leading them to reluctantly discover the polarity of the left, but when it comes to the right polarity, too many on the right refuse to see it. Unlike cutting your left arm off, making your right arm the one left, if you cut your right arm off, then your left arm is still left. For the left in this scenario, it's a win-win. Heads I win, tails you lose. And in the binary world of electoral politics, labels are critical, and it is always to the advantage of the sinister left to destroy the true identity of that which is right. It's define or be defined, and the traditional right has allowed itself to be defined by its ideological enemies, having been lulled into the false belief that such labels no longer matter. But try as they might, they find themselves forced to use the very labels to which they object. The debate over left and right is showing no signs of abating, but is instead turning into a frantic mission to define and identify and distinguish friends from enemies, on the political front, which has now become a front of violence. And as we've been arguing for years, being able to recognize the natural and critical polarity between the left and right is not a matter of semantics, but about survival itself. It's like knowing the difference between eating healthy food and consuming poison. So to that end, today we'll be exploring not only the differences between the polarities of left and right, but also the differences between the left and the left wing, and the right wing. Hopefully, we'll be able to enlighten some confused voices on the left and right alike who are just winging it and losing their own political identities in the process. It all begins right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Now, originally inspired by Sky News Australia's Rita Panahi series called Lefties Losing It, we've titled this week's show Losers Lefting It, which pretty much describes the nature of those who end up on the left. That was certainly self-evident during our broadcast of September 10th, which described and illustrated anti-capitalists as being lazy, envious losers. And they did it in their own words. Communism, fascism, socialism, and anarchy are all collectivist ideologies of the left. The right is all about individualism, freedom, and capitalism. So it's easy for those on the right to simply condemn the left as being evil, godless, a death cult, and all the rest of the moral criteria that in a given context are certainly so. But none of these reactions by themselves address the way that those on the left actually think, and why those on the left think that they're the good guys. So on the heels of the recent Charlie Kirk assassination, the pathetic and continuing lies being spewed by Jimmy Kimmel upon his return to ABC, and fears that an outright socialist might become the next mayor of New York City, It was serendipitous that I should have picked up an old publication that has long been in my own print library entitled Why You Should Be a Socialist. The 50-page booklet was published in Canada in 1994 as an international socialist pamphlet and was written by David Camfield, who I was shocked to learn by searching his name online, that he continues to this day to be a professor of labor studies at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, where his preferred pronouns are he and they. Oh, give me a break. I find it difficult to even take anybody like that seriously. But when I went through the booklet, I suddenly realized the value of this publication. It is a statement in the words of a socialist himself that reveals many of the false definitions, failures in logic, and an agenda of envy and greed. The pamphlet, in the very first sentence of its introduction, begins with a glaringly false premise. Quote, "It is clear to millions of people that capitalism, the system that dominates every country in the world, is not working," end quote. Well, that's not so unlike the placards and signs we've seen the anti-capitalists among us today carrying around to demonstrate their ignorance and stupidity. Nowhere in the entire 50-page pamphlet is there a definition of capitalism, and with good reason. David Camfield is a socialist, and the left is in the business of concept destroying and creating anti-concepts so as to destroy people's ability to reason and think. He has a lot to say about what he thinks is wrong with capitalism, but is in every case citing symptoms of collectivism, as we shall soon see. Now, we must start with a definition, and of course the best definition and description of capitalism was offered by Ayn Rand. Quote, "Capitalism is a social system based on the recognition of individual rights, including property rights, in which all property is privately owned," end quote. So, that's the definition. Now here's the description. Quote, "The recognition of individual rights entails the banishment of physical force from human relationships. Basically, rights can be violated only by means of force. In a capitalist society, no man or group may initiate the use of physical force against others. The only function of government in such a society is the task of protecting man's rights, the task of protecting him from physical force. The government acts as the agent of man's right of self-defense and may use force only in retaliation and only against those who initiate its use. Thus, the government is the means of placing the retaliatory use of force under objective control," end quote. Now, empowered with an objective and accurate definition of capitalism, consider what David Camfield is saying when he has the outrageous gall to say that capitalism is the system that dominates every country in the world. So in other words, Communist China, the Soviet Union of his time, which had just dissolved 2 years earlier, all the tribalist republics of Africa, etc., etc., are nations that uphold individual rights, private property, and the prohibition of physical force in human relationships. That is so effing crazy that it's difficult to see how anyone can take such a retarded statement seriously, let alone its university-employed author. And perhaps that's why American author, political commentator, activist, and former radio host Michael Savage concluded that leftist liberalism is a mental disorder during his September 19 appearance on the Alex Jones Show, from which we'll hear a part on this side of the upcoming bumper. And to illustrate his conclusion on the return side of the bumper, courtesy of Rebel Media and Ezra Levant, Canada's own leftist liberal Prime Minister Mark Carney, delivering a word salad that makes Kamala Harris sound like a genius.
Michael Savage is here with us, limited time with him. He's focusing on free speech, and the UK is the epicenter laboratory for control. Everything they do there in the EU, they want to bring here as well. He got banned many years ago when this first started from the UK. Now Trump's over there excoriating Starmer to his face. You got a million people marching with Tommy Robinson. This is beautiful. But you read a quote, and I read your book many years ago. I forgot this. Winston Churchill was prescient, a prophet, predicting how the socialist, Fabian socialist, a liberal party in the UK would try to take over with soft tyranny. Read that quote again, and then you got the floor, sir.
Churchill, in the book, Banned in Britain,
which is no longer in print. People say, oh, you're selling a book. Well, if I were, you'd be knowing I am, but I'm not. In 1945, Winston Churchill said the following, and I'll read it again. No socialist government conducting the entire life and industry of the country could afford to allow free, sharp, or violently worded expressions of public discontent. They would have to fall back on some form of Gestapo, no doubt very humanely directed in the first instance. And this would nip opinion in the bud. It would stop criticism as it reared its head, and it would gather all the power to the Supreme Party and the party leaders, rising like stately pinnacles above their vast bureaucracies of civil servants, no longer servants and no longer civil. Amen, huh? If we don't stop this attack upon our freedom of speech, they can declare us persona non grata.
What did you think when you saw Bondi 2 days ago say, literally spout the line, you got free speech but not hate speech?
Well, who's going to define hate speech? One person's patriotic speech is the other person's hate speech. But the sword cuts two ways. So now we're seeing the left saying vile things about Charlie Kirk, which we all hate, correct?
Yes.
But we can't do anything about it. Let them make the asses of themselves that they are. Let them get fired from the job. Okay, if they want to say stupid, horrible things like that. They're not being sued for free speech. They're being sued for violently false speech, which is different than hate speech. And they're making things up about this man that he never said. Look, I watched Charlie's speeches. This guy was actually a middle-of-the-road conservative Christian, wouldn't you say?
If anything, he was criticized for not being hardcore. No, he was dangerous because he was so...
Exactly. So Charlie was reaching across all party lines, reaching young people with a very clear, moderate message that resonated with people. That's why they killed him, whoever did it. They killed him because he was a moderate. That's the whole point. He was far more influential than some of us flaming right-wingers.
In the limited time we have left, let's talk about Jimmy Kimmel. He had almost no viewers. They admit the Democrats wrote most of his talking points.
He was a talentless schmender. This guy was like a, what did I call him? A knish with eyes. He had the brains of a knish, you know, a potato knish made of potatoes and dough. He's like a doughboy that people put words into him and they yap, just attack people on the right, attack Trump and make believe you're a real smart boy. He had no real talent. You know, during the writer's strike, these guys had to go off the air, Alex. They couldn't do what you and I do, which is talk extemporaneously. They needed a script, Alex, because they were reading the script of the boys behind the scenes who control the puppeteer, the puppet's mouth. He was a lightweight. He wasn't funny. There's a way to do things on both sides of the aisle with humor. I don't see any humor in anything this man has ever said. I found it to be very, very shallow, no intellectual depth, no knowledge of history, no love for the country, an all-around lightweight individual who they used as a puppet, as I've said earlier, to espouse their far-left radical ideas. And he went over the line by attacking an otherwise decent middle-of-the-road conservative Christian, Charlie Kirk. There was no reason for that.
They really crossed the line here. What do you think they've done here, and why are they so tone-deaf?
Well, they're tone deaf because liberalism is a mental disorder. People don't seem to understand. I wrote that book in 2003, and people call me and say, I don't know why they're doing this, why they're doing that. I said, if you plug this into the formula, it answers your question. Liberalism is a mental disorder. If you're mentally disordered, you can't think reasonably. You act emotionally, and then you go to the deepest part of your emotions, which usually contains hatred, and the hatred comes out. And that is what we are seeing from the left. It's like a gigantic purge of everything that is in them. It's all evil. It's all dark. It's all vile. It's all hateful. And it's all very, very deadly and dangerous for a nation because liberalism, my friends, unfortunately, is now a violent mental disorder.
Yesterday, Carney started talking about a vision for a new kind of economy. Now, whenever a politician talks about a new kind of economy, hold on to your wallet, because odds are it's not a new idea at all. Odds are it's just a repackaged version of socialism, sort of hijacking capitalism, taking it away from shareholder rights towards stakeholder rights, and replacing the free market with a managed market. So from the very beginning, you should be on guard about Mark Carney. Here he is in New York, and I want to play 3 full minutes of him describing what he wants to do, not just to Canada's economy, but to the world's economy.
The way I'm going to organize my thoughts, 4 points actually, around building that system, financial system for our grandkids, again, drawing on the intervention of the managing director and the secretary general earlier. First thing we need is to recognize that we need to use scarce dollars to the maximum effect. This isn't just about bigger volumes, it's about using scarce public dollars to maximum effect. And that is catalyzing financial instruments, using risk mitigation tools to better allocate risk between the public and private sector. I will just refer for speed to the agenda of the Private Sector Investment Lab and what the World Bank has been doing on risk management. The second point is crowding in institutional capital through originate to distribute models. There's a lot of words there. What it basically means is recycling the balance sheets of our international financial institutions. So they are there catalyzing the new lending. Once it matures, it's parked off to other holders that can hold it for the long term. And it's all about action, new action at the MDBs. The third point is strengthening the structures, processes, governance of the institutions. To put it into plain words, the shareholders should be looking at key performance indicators that are directly tied, of course, to the Sustainable Development Goals, but also absolute volumes of capital that are moving. And in some cases, it's not about lending. It's actually about technical assistance. It's making capital flow possible. So all of those activities that catalyze in flows towards the SDGs. I will reference the work that has been done and needs to be completed on a cross-border carbon market, which could close one-third of the climate finance gap between now and 2035. And I will also just associate myself with the framework that President Ramaphosa did outlined for the G20, which is more comprehensive than what I've just said. Last point I'll make is that at the G7, there were a few instruments that were launched that build on some of the general points that I just made. Billions of dollars in new financing through the IADB and the Caribbean Development Bank, and a structure where a number of countries came together called SCALE, which is Scaling Capital for Sustainable Development. The point of this, it's measured in billions, but really the point is it's a template. It's a template for putting in place those general points that I made. It has, as its name suggests, an ability to scale. And if I may close on this, Chair, there is an enormous gap. We know that. But the gap in terms of financial technology and the solutions has closed. The question is whether we're going to deploy them and scale.
Wow, talk about a pile of verbal excrement. I am so embarrassed and ashamed for Canada that I just cannot find words suitable enough to counter that magnificent word salad of incoherence and BS. Canada's Mark Carney has just offered us a first-hand exhibit of the mental disorder associated with leftist liberalism as described by Michael Savage. There were, however, a few recognizable terms repeated in that jumble of non-sequiturs. Key among them, sustainable development, yet another socialist anti-concept, attempting to justify and finance unsustainable socialism by the private sector and taxpayers. Do you know how to recognize something that's unsustainable? Simple. If the government's financing a project in any way, that's unsustainable by definition. Otherwise, state financing would not be necessary. Other alarming terms used by Carney were carbon market and climate finance gap. The structures, processes, governance of the institutions, to put into plain words, the shareholders should be looking at key performance indicators that are directly tied, of course, to the sustainable development goals, but also absolute volumes of capital that are moving. And in some cases, it's not about lending, it's actually about technical assistance. It's making capital flow possible, so all those activities that catalyzing flows towards the SDGs, I will reference the work which has been done and needs to be completed on a cross-border carbon market, which could close one-third of the climate finance gap between now in 2035. That was actually the direct quote. Or in other words, we recommend establishing a global fascist state under which development and production will be curtailed and ceased. What I want to know is, who are these shareholders that he keeps talking about? Well, Ezra Levant pretty much nailed it when he described Carney's agenda as hijacking capitalism from shareholder rights to stakeholder rights and replacing the free market with a managed market, which is exactly what I just described as a global fascist state. But it still leaves the fundamental question unanswered. What I want to know is, who are these stakeholders, if you prefer to use that utterly fraudulent term? When Carney verbally masturbates using Karl Marx's language of fools with phrases like building a financial system for our grandkids, or we need to use scarce dollars to the maximum effect, he's counting on no one noticing that he's a complete fascist, and I'm not just using that as a pejorative. Again, fascism is state control of private property and of private choices, and that's exactly what Carney is advocating. What the hell does building a financial system for our grandkids possibly mean? What our grandkids and everyone else on the planet needs in terms of a financial system is freedom and capitalism. And leave my grandkids alone, you pervert. What a train wreck. And then there was Michael Savage, who portrayed Charlie Kirk's message as a clear, moderate message that resonated with people. And he says that they killed him because he was a moderate and far more influential than some of us flaming right-wingers. But I don't think Charlie's message was a moderate message at all. The truth is never moderate, meaning some blend between truth and falsehood. If Charlie Kirk was moderate, it wasn't about his message, it was about the manner in which he delivered it. There was nothing moderate about Kirk's message in any way, and if he was killed because of his message, it was because it was a message of the right. In particular, one that was not afraid to confront the left in an open forum. But I can guarantee you that those on the left who so hated Charlie Kirk most definitely saw him as a flaming right-winger. Which brings us back to why you should be a socialist, according to socialist David Camfield. Before the break, we learned that the first sentence in his booklet was a false assertion that every country in the world is predominantly capitalist. And similarly, in the first sentence of a chapter entitled The Failure of Capitalism, Camfield confesses to the truth about the success of capitalism, but regards that success as a failure. And I quote, "The most astonishing fact about the world today is that although more wealth is produced every year, inequality continues to increase," end quote. Now remember, he just argued that capitalism was the predominant system in every country in the world, and that more wealth is produced every year. Well, if that's true, then how can you argue that capitalism isn't working? Of course, all of that was pure BS and contradiction coming from him and the left, which is all that it is capable of given its epistemology. But the failure to which he really objects is inequality. He said so, as if that were some kind of social problem that needs to be solved. He's not talking about inequality before and under the law, which is the principle under which the left operates. He's talking about economic inequality, which is a non-issue disguised as some kind of moral ideal of equity, which is immoral. Equity is an economic concept of the left, as contrasted to the right moral concept of equality. But you know what causes inequality? It's the production of wealth. That's why all socialism wages a war on wealth. This is purely motivated by the evil of envy and on an ignorance or denial so profound that most rational people cannot fathom it. Now here's a very simple kindergarten example of what I'm talking about. Suppose two individuals named Peter and Paul live on an uncharted island in identical huts and each owned and produced nothing, living off the fruits and vegetation provided them by nature. Then they would be equal in terms of their wealth. Neither would be poor or rich. since either word would have no meaning or reference to its opposite concept. Nobody's poor because there's no one else around who's rich or wealthy. But the minute, say, that Peter plants a garden and tends some livestock to improve his life and Paul does not, then Paul is in relative poverty. He's economically unequal compared to Peter, even though nothing has changed in his own personal circumstances. But Peter did not cause Paul's inequality, since Paul's wealth status has remained unchanged. But a socialist would come along and accuse Peter of causing Paul's economic condition and demand that Peter give Paul the wealth created by Peter's efforts. After all, it was Peter's actions that caused the wealth gap, and therefore it's Peter's fault that Paul is poor, and therefore that is a social injustice. So what's the socialist solution? Well, just rob Peter to pay Paul. Sound familiar? Inequality in the sense of an economic comparative to anyone with more wealth than a given poor individual is a meaningless issue, and it doesn't require a cure or a response. However, starvation and disease and crime are other matters entirely, and these are conditions routinely associated with collectivist societies and never with individualist capitalist societies. We'll get to more of these socialist delusions shortly, but first, given Mark Carney's filling the climate finance gap plan, I wonder how he would respond to U.S. President Donald Trump's recent address to the UN, during which Trump referred to climate change as the, quote, greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world, end quote, citing UN climate change predictions that were all wrong and that were, quote, made by stupid people, end quote. Well, on this side of our upcoming bumper, we'll hear Trump himself address that issue, along with the issue of illegal immigration, followed by X22 reporting on the dirty tricks played on Trump by UN organizers. Unbelievable. Along with his observations that the UN is a socialist and communist organization dedicated to the destruction of freedom and capitalism. And on the return side of the bumper, General Michael Flynn, in conversation with Alex Jones, warns of the coming dangers associated with the Marxist and socialist left's alliance with Islamism in America, while arguing that we have to stop this political two-party game that we're playing.
So go to Trump declaring war on the UN, calling them out their face.
Not only is the UN not solving the problems it should too often, it's actually creating new problems for us to solve. The best example is the number one political issue of our time, the crisis of uncontrolled migration. It's uncontrolled. Your countries are being ruined. The United Nations is funding an assault on Western countries and their borders. In 2024, the UN budgeted $372 million in cash assistance to support an estimated 624,000 migrants journeying into the United States. Think of that. The UN is supporting people that are illegally coming into the United States, and then we have to get them out. The UN also provided food, shelter, transportation, and debit cards to illegal aliens. Can you believe that? On the way to infiltrate our southern border. Millions of people came through that southern border. Just a year ago, millions and millions of people were pouring in, 25 million altogether over the 4 years of the incompetent Biden administration. And now we have it stopped, totally stopped. In fact, they're not even coming anymore because they know they can't get through. But what took place is totally unacceptable. The UN is supposed to stop invasions, not create them and not finance them. In the United States, we reject the idea that mass numbers of people from foreign lands can be permitted to travel halfway around the world, trample our borders, violate our sovereignty, cause unmitigated crime, and deplete our social safety net. Global warming, not happening. You know, it used to be global cooling. If you look back years ago in the 1920s and the 1930s, they said global cooling will kill the world. We have to do something. Then they said global warming will kill the world. But then it started getting cooler. So now they could just call it climate change because that way they can't miss. It's climate change. Because if it goes higher or lower, whatever the hell happens, there's climate change. It's the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world, in my opinion. climate change. No matter what happens, you're involved in that. No more global warming, no more global cooling. All of these predictions made by the United Nations and many others, often for bad reasons, were wrong. They were made by stupid people that have cost their country's fortunes and given those same countries no chance for success. If you don't get away from this green scam, your country is going to fail. And Europe, on the other hand, has a long way to go, with many countries being on the brink of destruction because of the green energy agenda. And I give a lot of credit to Germany. Germany was being led down a very sick path, both on immigration, by the way, and on energy. They were going green and they were going bankrupt. And the new leadership came in and they went back to where they were, with fossil fuel and with nuclear, which is good. It's now safe and you can do it properly. But they went back to where they were and they opened up a lot of different plants, energy producing plants, and they're doing well. I give Germany a lot of credit for that. They've said this is a disaster, what's happening. They were going all green. All green is all bankrupt. That's what it represents. And it's not politically correct. I'll be very badly criticized for saying it, but I'm here to tell the truth. I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. If you don't get away from this green scam, your country is going to fail. And I'm really good at predicting things, you know. They actually said during the campaign they had a hat. The best-selling hat. Trump was right about everything. And I don't say that in a braggadocious way, but it's true. I've been right about everything. And I'm telling you that if you don't get away from the green energy scam, your country is going to fail. And if you don't stop people that you've never seen before, that you have nothing in common with, your country is going to fail. In honor of this momentous anniversary, I hope that all countries who find inspiration in our example will join us in renewing our commitment, values, and those values, really, that we hold so dear together. Let us defend free speech and free expression. Let us protect religious liberty, including for the most persecuted religion on the planet today. It's called Christianity. And let us safeguard our sovereignty and cherish qualities that have made each of our nations so special, incredible, and extraordinary.
Once again, we could see that Trump, he is now shutting down the UN. And the UN tried to actually shut him down. And they tried it 3 times. And he responded to all of this and said, a real disgrace took place at the United Nations yesterday. Not one, not two, but 3 very sinister events. 3 strikes, you're out. First, the escalator going up to the main speaking floor came to a screeching halt. It stopped on a dime. It's amazing that Melania and I didn't fall forward onto the sharp edges of these steel steps, face first. Were they doing that on purpose? Were they trying to kill them? Maybe. It was only that we were each holding the handrail tightly, or it would have been a disaster. This was absolutely sabotage, as noted by a day's earlier post in the London Times, that said UN workers joked about turning off an escalator. The people that did it should be arrested. Then, as I stood there before a television crowd of millions of people all over the world and important leaders in the hall, my teleprompter didn't work. It was stone cold dark. I immediately thought to myself, wow, first the escalator vent and now a bad teleprompter? What kind of place is this? I then proceeded to make a speech without a teleprompter, which kicked in about 15 minutes later. The good news is the speech has gotten a fantastic reviews. Maybe they appreciated the fact that the very few people could have done what I did. And third, after making the speech, I was told that the sound was completely off in the auditorium where the speech was made. The world leaders, unless they used the interpreter's earpiece, couldn't hear a thing. The first person I saw at the conclusion of the speech was Melania, who was sitting right up front. I said, "How did I do?" And she said, "I couldn't hear a word you said." This wasn't a coincidence. This was triple sabotage at the UN. They ought to be ashamed of themselves. I'm sending a copy of this letter to the Secretary General, and I demand an immediate investigation. No wonder the United Nations hasn't been able to do the job that they were put into existence to do. All security tapes at the escalator should be saved, especially the emergency stop button. The Secret Service is involved. Thank you for your attention to this matter. And yes, they should track down and find out who these people are. Unbelievable. And this is just something that's very, very interesting, and Wall Street Maverick put this out. The United States pays 25% of the United Nations budget, but only 4% of the UN employees are American. The UN is filled with socialists and communists in all of the key decision-making roles, deciding how the $67 billion budget is spent. So basically, we know that the reason for this is because the UN, the WHO, the World Economic Forum, the World Bank, is one gigantic communist Marxist organization. And their main goal is to shut down the United States and actually have the sovereignty of the United States moved into the United Nations, which is not going to happen. And eventually what is going to happen is Trump is most likely going to defund the whole thing and move us away from the UN. Because do we really need the UN? Remember, going back in time, the UN was only for peacekeeping, to have all the leaders come together and talk about peace so we don't have World War 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. But is that what the UN is doing now? No, not at all.
We have got to be ready for war, right? You got China breathing down our necks, and they're not just breathing down our necks in the Pacific or the Asia Pacific basin or in the Panama Canal. They're breathing down our necks right here in our own hemisphere and right here in the United States of America. And then the last thing, which is really the most important threat that I feel that we face, and that's a Marxist socialist element inside of the United States government. And I call it an unholy alliance. It's this unholy alliance between these isms, right? Communism and Islamism. Sorry, but that's just the way it is. People can name call me all they want.
The level of violence is accelerating. Charlie Kirk killed. But, and just to put a finer point on this, sir.
So we know from the last 4 years, the infiltration of elements inside of our government, right? Iranian teams. We have Hamas and Hezbollah who have been here for decades. Never mind just coming in over the last
who are allied with the
years.
Democrats.
We've seen. Yeah, absolutely. 100% allied with the left, okay? And the left loves to use words like liberals and progressives. It is Marxists and socialists, and they align themselves in an unholy way with the radical Islamists who are out there among our midst. I mean, we just had the National Counterterrorism Center put out a report a week and a half ago or so about Al-Qaeda, right? About Al-Qaeda being inside of the United States, getting ready to potentially conduct attacks. And so the projection of deception is a Saul Alinsky type operation, right? It's a rules for radicals. It's a Marxist socialist type of warfare technique. And this idea of projecting on us what they are actually doing to us. It's a technique. It's called sowing chaos. Okay. Sowing chaos. And that's exactly what they're doing. We're getting ready to have a radicalized socialist Muslim Islamist as the mayor of New York City if some miracle doesn't occur in the next couple of months here. So again, they're on the warpath, they being this radicalized Marxist element, these elements inside of our government that are led by, frankly, the Chinese are right at the top of that heap. These plans exist, and there's a combination of these types of plans. And I've actually seen some of them, and I've certainly read the Chinese version of this plan, which these people are aligned. We have to stop this political, two-party system game that we're playing here. I can be the eternal optimist, but I want people to be realistic about what it is that we are facing.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. And when it comes to stopping this political two-party game, as General Flynn refers to it, the way to do that is to stop winging it in the political arena. We need a two-party polarity, not party wings. That's because the left wing and the right wing are not so different from each other. Instead of representing individual rights, each wing represents a different interest group. Traditionally, left-wing groups like to restrict our economic choices, limit trade, and monopolize labor, while right-wing groups like to restrict our personal choices, control trade, and monopolize business. The groups who claim to be middle of the road simply like to do both, and the road they're talking about is the road to total state control of our personal lives, which leads both wings directly into the polarity of the left. A uniparty, as many have come to call it, in the absence of recognizing the missing polarity on the right. But the awakening to the fact that the left and right are polarities, not wings of a single polarity, is a painful discovery for many, as we will hear in our next two upcoming audio bites. On this side of the bumper, Nick Freitas, who says his mission is to destroy leftist ideology, but who, instead of promoting and building the freedom capitalism ideology of the right, does the religious righteous thing by offering Christianity and God as the antidote to the left, about which there is nothing politically right being offered. And on the return side of the bumper, just listen to how John Popola, in conversation with Peter Boghossian on Dad Saves America, actually finds himself so painfully forced to use the word polarity, as their conversation never arrives at a clear recognition of what that polarity is.
How do we defeat the left for good? Is that even possible? And what do we mean when we say the left? Last episode, we talked about why Charlie Kirk's death has in fact changed everything. But we were very specific. It wasn't just his murder. It was the left's response to his murder. We talked about the various criteria that we see going on within political discourse. We talked about things like the different sides of the political spectrum having diametrically opposed worldviews. We talked about the glorification of political violence. And we talked about what happens when a political movement has a critical mass which believes these things and is willing to openly celebrate it. And we came to the conclusion that's where the left is at in this country. We also came to the conclusion that this is not something where the right woke up one day and declared the left our enemies. Rather, what we recognize is that for well over a decade now, perhaps even longer, the left has considered us their enemy. And we just stopped disagreeing with that definition. So, what do we do about it? But today, I'm going to go a little bit more into what has happened in our own country and how we reverse the various trends that have taken place and get to a place where we can have civil disagreements with one another, but that sort of society requires some sort of shared commitment to fundamental principles, which doesn't currently exist. So when we say the left, we do not mean like your neighbor who tends to vote Democrat, who wants a slightly higher marginal tax rate, right? That person may be on the left when it comes to their political philosophy, but they're not a leftist. When we talk about the left, we mean something, or leftist, we mean something pretty specific. My mission is to destroy leftist ideology. That I consider that my mission. I want to destroy leftist ideology. And what I mean by that is I want it to be thought of like Nazism is thought of. I want it to be thought of as so morally and socially unacceptable that to call oneself a leftist is to voluntarily accept being ostracized by the rest of the country. Because I believe it is a very, very corrosive, degrading, and at its heart, evil ideology. But what do we mean by that? So Christian, let's talk a little bit about this because, again, it's not just free healthcare, right? That's not what we mean when we talk about leftism.
No, I mean, the left, as we think about it, is a secular religion. Mm-hmm. It has all the hallmarks of it. I would argue that it's what happens when you take Christianity and you actually strip Christ out of Christianity.
I don't think it's, I wouldn't give it that much credit, but I get what you're saying.
The point is that it does function like a religion. You're dealing with a specific worldview that approaches history as it's moving towards an end goal, right? It's this view of, you know, they call themselves progressives, mm-hmm. right? It's this idea that we're progressing towards something. And what's that we're progressing towards? Endless liberation, right? Yeah. Total liberation of the individual. And they don't mean it in just like the libertarian sense. What they mean it by is you should be free from all unchosen obligations. Mm-hmm. When you were born, it's not as if your consciousness was this free-floating thing that chose a soul to inhabit.
Yeah.
You are the product of generations of history that came before you. Even the very language that you're using to articulate mm-hmm. your thoughts and your speech, you didn't come up with that. That came from thousands of years of the evolution of, in our case, the English language. Mm-hmm. And the same thing of your nation is the product of hundreds of years of history. Your family, your lineage is the product of hundreds of years of history. So if you want to liberate the individual from all unchosen obligations, what you end up inevitably what you're going to produce is a fully atomized individual that's divorced from any relations with anybody else.
Yeah, customs, religion, tradition, and anything that could be said to be imposed on one just by the very nature of its existence. And I think you also see this in the way they talk about rights. It's fascinating because they will make these false equivalencies between, like, you know, human beings are the only ones that have to work to survive. Like, no, everything has to work to survive. Or they'll say they're the ones that need money to survive. No, money is actually a human invention, which actually makes surviving and transactions significantly easier. You're right. The cow doesn't need to use currency in order to get the grass. Would you like to go live off of eating grass? Like, would you like to join the cow
in the state of nature?
In the state of nature that Jean-Jacques Rousseau is so you know, enamored with. So if you look at, we'll say, the structure of Christianity. The structure of Christianity is this idea. I believe a true idea. I'm a Christian, that there is a God. God created the earth. He created morality. Like, he's the source of truth, of love, of justice. He created human beings. Human beings were given the option to not follow God. We engaged in sin. There's consequences for those sins. In order for God to maintain love and justice, there has to be a way to reconcile that while maintaining justice. So you can't just forgive everything that was done, or else justice isn't satisfied. Whether you believe it or not, there's a very coherent and logical thought process within this idea of Christianity and Christian faith. And then God also commands us to do things. Like, we are commanded to see other people as made in the image of God. And so there's this inherent dignity which exists as a result of being created in the image of God. But not all actions are dignified. Not all mm-hmm. actions are moral, right? There's sinful actions, and then there's righteous actions. And so,
isn't it interesting how the left's approach to Christianity is always, you know, tolerance and forgive.
Yes,
and,
yes.
But at the same token, they've also divorced the Christ figure from it.
And so when we say that this version of leftism is its own theology, what we mean is it seeks to replace God and essentially replace it with the idea that you can be your own God. And this idea of the what Marx called, like, the dictatorship of the proletariat, is that we're now going to all get to be our little own gods, but then we work in concert with one another to create this utopia.
Yes.
Which is heaven on earth through the dictatorship of the proletariat. And the reason why it's important to understand it within this framework is because, whereas God is offering an objective truth and an objective morality for which he is the author, and it's not up to us to decide what that truth is. It's not up for us to decide what the morality is. We discover it. It is revealed. And then God says, operate within this framework. And operate within this framework and positive things will happen. Operate outside of this framework and negative things happen.
But I do want to tell you a very quick story.
Please.
So Reed and I were invited to a campfire, where people sitting around a campfire. And there were two women who worked with each other at this office, doesn't matter where it is. So one of these women spontaneously started crying about Charlie Kirk. And I tried to console her. Reed was talking to the other woman. And the other woman was not belligerent, but extremely dismissive. And then the woman who was sobbing about Charlie Kirk pointed to me and whispered, "She's a liberal, she's a liberal." And the woman literally got up and left and walked to the other side of the campfire, because she hated Charlie Kirk, and she said some things immediately before that. And I told Reed, how on earth are we going to get over this? Like, these are two people who are friends. Everybody was chilling at the campfire. Everybody's drinking. We were having some wine. Everybody's having a good time. The thing that blew me away, John, about that, is, like, she could have easily said, "Charlie Kirk, I hate him. I hate everything he believes in. I think he's wrong. I think he's immoral. But I don't think he should have been murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the lowest bar.
Yeah.
And we can't even get people to agree that we don't murder our political opponents. That's the state we're in now.
I was having a conversation that reminds me of this, this woman saying she's a liberal about her friend.
Yeah.
And that's
I don't think that's the right word, by the way, but
no,
anyway.
And that's what I find interesting in thinking about this is, so we have these categories, left and right, and they go back to the French Revolution, and those on the right wanted to preserve essentially the status quo, the monarchy, the aristocracy, and those on the left wanted revolution. And it's easy to say, well, that's this sort of like anachronism that's held over, but there's a couple other things that feed into this. This weird polarity, like the fact that we still say left and right, the fact that conservative and versus, like, I'm grappling with, like, what do these things really mean today for real? Because it's not clear. Like, in one sense, you could say that, like, a liberal, like a classical liberal, like that America is essentially a liberal country. That the Declaration of Independence, that the, you know, Thomas Jefferson was super excited about the French Revolution. He was on the left in there. If Jefferson was in that chamber in France, he would be on the left. And yet today he is understood as being someone that's like the closest we had in our founders to probably like an anarcho-capitalist right winger. How do you think about this? How do you think about ways, and there can be more than one rubric, but how do you think about what are the parts that are dividing us? Because I think some of it's political.
Question.
Yeah, some of it's psychological. Some of it speaks to like the righteous mind and the different moral palettes and stuff. How do you think about that?
That's a great question. I don't think about it in terms of right-left. I don't think about it in terms of conservative-liberal. People don't even use those words, liberal. They lump left and liberal together, which is a problem. Then there's classical liberal. In Australia, the liberals are really the conservatives. So I don't think that those are good heuristics or good ways to even think about the problem. I think about the problem in terms of totalitarianism. Like, who's an authoritarian? Who's not an authoritarian? I am not an authoritarian. Many on the left are authoritarians. Many on the right are authoritarians too, but it does seem that the left is increasing their real estate in authoritarian propositions. So the way I think about it is who's principled and who's not principled.
I'm thinking about that. Principled. Does principled work there? Because you can have someone who's principled committed to the destruction of the very fundamental assumptions we're making.
Correct.
They're against merit. They don't believe explicitly.
Merit is racist.
The notion of the rule of law or equality under the law, equal treatment under the law, immaterial of your identity. Like, okay, we're just going to adjust the facts and have an impartial judge. They reject that. It's part of this critical legal doctrine.
So when you say principled, the
question
is—
Aren't they principled, I guess, is the simple question.
Yes. And one can be principled about the wrong things. That's why the most important thing in any conversation is epistemology, is how you know what you think you know. Your epistemology should always precede everything. And the problem is that we have a society that has that ass backward. We write off competing evidence as anomalous or what have you. We the same way we find our news sources, and we want to justify the things that we already believe. You know why? I'm going to tell you why you shouldn't take these people seriously. They're pathological liars. Nobody can admit they've made a mistake and they were hoodwinked by a deranged ideology, particularly because, in all fairness, it was so insane and so stupid that it is a moral embarrassment. So the way to deal with these people on an institutional level is to defund all of them. And the way to, that's the way to deal with the institutions. And then the way to deal with the people is to forgive them and move forward.
I couldn't possibly agree more with the program that you just described.
I can't say the same, I'm afraid. Certainly, defund all institutions of taxpayers' money. But on the forgiveness issue, that would have to come at a price. One paid by those being forgiven, and certainly not on a blanket scale. But when it comes to any so-called Karens out there, you know, those people who turned innocent people into authorities for anything from social distancing to lockdowns to forced therapeutic injections, and so severely affected their lives, they should be held personally accountable, both through public shaming and by allowing their victims to sue for damages. If people never have to pay a price for being, quote, insane, stupid, and morally embarrassing, end quote, they'll just continue to be so at the first sign of the next state-created fake crisis. When Peter Boghossian rejects the left-right polarities in favor of a word like authoritarian, that only muddles the whole political polarity. Many on the left are authoritarian, and many on the right are authoritarian, he argues, but he's talking about the wings, not the polarity. Authoritarianism is utterly incompatible with the right, given its freedom capitalist philosophy. Ironically, he correctly identified epistemology as the key to resolving political identities, but still found himself trapped in the false logic of a political spectrum. But in the binary world of electoral politics, it's not just about we the people versus authoritarianism. It's really more about we the people on the right versus they, the people on the left. And this is the reality that so many on the right seem unwilling to come to terms with, because being good-natured folks at heart, they suffer from the delusion that the right and left can possibly unite or work together under some common cause, which is not possible given the left's violent-based ideologies. And finally, one last quote from anti-capitalist David Camfield, quote, "Capitalism's profit-driven logic also makes it an incredibly inefficient way of producing goods and services. There's no coordination between companies, so there are always several firms competing with each other to sell similar or identical commodities to the same people. This leads to wasted resources. Companies can't predict how many units of a particular product will sell. As a result, what tends to happen is that either too many or too few items are made. If there aren't enough units of some product available, several companies may end up rushing in to meet the demand. But since they are in a desperate competition with each other, they will tend to produce more than they can sell, and the result is more waste," end quote. Wow. Nowhere in Camfield's entire 50-page diatribe does he mention or acknowledge prices or the pricing system. That's how companies predict how much of something to produce. If, relative to a given demand, they overproduce, then prices drop. If they underproduce, prices rise. Duh. The point to be made here is that both Canadian and American universities are filled with professors just as socialist retarded as is David Camfield. And that's why the left will never disappear from our scene. Now, there have been numerous reports emerging, all concerning how so many people who previously identified with the left are abandoning the Democratic Party, and then conclude that the left is collapsing. Well, it isn't. But if it was true, that brings us back to our show opener today. If you cut off your left arm, then your right arm will be left. Play on words aside, the same metaphor applies on an individual basis when the political left is cut off. The party on the right will become left. A lot of those who switch from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party will bring their leftist beliefs and superstitions with them, adding their influence to the already existing rhinos in the party, potentially turning the supposedly right Republican Party into a party of the left, which it's not far from being already. Now, there's a great irony in the fact that so many people want to just be in some kind of political center, when the only way to do that is to be just right. Remember, when we use the term just right, that represents the ideal Goldilocks zone. Not too hot, not too cold, but just right, which is about as centered as you can get. So, for more of a viewpoint that is not center-right, but both centered and just right, be sure to join us again next week when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be all right.
Hey, Jimmy?
Yes.
Please kick his ass, okay?
I will do my best, Nancy.
All right, thank you.
I'm dedicating this to you.
Oh, thanks. You may or may not know, but I have 10 questions in my hand, and you will have 60 seconds to answer
them.
Is
it cool if I masturbate in here?
Yes.
Because usually the booths, you know, the hot chick,
yeah.
The whole thing.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. That is perfectly
fine. You have any
fine.
Tokens?